It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And we are joined today by a special guest, Mike Petriello of MLB.com, unofficial title StatCast Guru, had a piece that went up earlier this week on five breakout starting pitchers. And we want to talk to Mike about a couple of things, about the pitchers in particular, but also kind of about what he looks for in making those assessments. Let's start with that. Are there one or two keys that you look for in doing a piece like this? Is it broad? How do you sort of attack it in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. The issue I always come with pieces like this is really defining what a breakout pitcher is, in the sense that, you know, did a guy already break out or not? So, for example, I obviously follow baseball very closely. I look at a guy like James Paxton and I think, oh yeah, he already kind of had his breakout season, you know, but he also went 6-7 with a 3.79 ERA. So I know to a lot of people, they look at that and they say, well, he didn't really have that great a season. I actually made a Twitter poll about it, asking people, did he break out already? Did he not break out already? Just because I wanted to know, you know, was I going too deep? Was I not going deep enough? And it was kind of 2/3 against saying, no, he had not had a breakout season yet. So that's kind of the threshold I went with here, because some of these names, you know, people have heard of, let's say Marcus Stroman, like that's not a name no one's ever heard of. So it's really about, you know, whether they've actually had like this big superficial season that counts as a breakout year. As far as what I look at, it's kind of a combination of things. It's, did a guy really show a particular skill in something, let's say strikeout rate, which is obviously, you can't fake that, or were there changes made around him? You know, did his team do something that's really going to make him be in a better position for success? Or did he make a change maybe in a pitch type or pitch usage that it made him look like a second half breakout is for real? Because you can't just look at a great September and say, okay, that guy's going to have a great season next year. Obviously, it doesn't work that way. But if there's something really tangible you can point to, you know, oh, his curveball got a lot better, or he picked up a new slider that really helped him out, that's really the kind of thing I look at and say, okay, I might be able to hang my hat on that as being something real for next year.
One guy that we have talked a lot about on this podcast that we sort of go back and forth about and that you address here is John Gray. And I think he's one of the most interesting pitchers for a lot of reasons. But, you know, obviously one of the big ones is Coors Field. And the point you make is that he may be, if not uniquely suited, at least particularly well suited to thrive at Coors Field. What gives you that confidence? Because I think there have been a lot of times over the years people have thought, oh, this is what it takes. What gives you the kind of confidence that this is what works for, this is why you would believe in a guy in Denver?
I think the number one thing a pitcher can do in Denver to succeed, it's not to get grounders, it's just to avoid contact at all. Because if hitters aren't putting it in play, then you're not worried about home runs, you're not worried about extra base hits in the giant Coors Field outfield. If you can miss bats, then you are way ahead of the curve there. And I think John Gray has clearly shown that skill. You look last year, he was a rookie, struck out 185 in 168 innings. I mean, that's really, really impressive. The fastball's for real. And when I look at guys in Coors Field, the secondary pitch I always like to see is the slider, because the curveball doesn't necessarily work so well at altitude. Change up sometimes, but if you have a really good slider, that can actually work pretty well in Coors Field, and that's probably his two best pitches are the fastball and the slider. He had a rough stretch in the middle of the year, a couple of back-to-back starts in August where he got lit up, and he basically said, my slider wasn't working. You know, it just wasn't moving. It was flat. When he's got those two pitches working, he can be really effective, and I think we saw that last year. Pretty interesting. He actually didn't have a huge split home and road. I mean, he was relatively effective in both areas. He's never going to have, you know, a 2.20 ERA or whatever, because I don't think any Rockies pitcher is ever going to have that. But he looked like the real deal. And again, he was a rookie last year. I mean, I always like guys who can come up to the big leagues and immediately show something interesting, because it's a good sign for what's going to happen as they mature.
Another guy that we talked about a lot last year was Marcus Stroman. And, you know, it was weird because I felt like he was overhyped coming into the year, and then he had a rough couple of months, and it was like everybody forgot that he was pretty good. And I realize to some extent you're not writing about perception, but about reality. But, you know, if you look at Stroman coming into this year and you kind of look at the overall conversation about him and look at the perception about him, you know, what do you think he is relative to that? Because I think that's, particularly from a fantasy perspective, that's obviously one of the questions. But, you know, this is a guy who was hyped as maybe a potential one or two type guy, then pitched like a four or five type guy. Where do you kind of view him sort of relative to expectations going into 17?
Yeah, I think you're pretty much right on with him. It feels like his breakout is about 2 years overdue. Because headed into 2015, I was, you know, super high in him, like I think a lot of people were. And then he blew out his knee in spring training, came back towards the end of the year. And then, you know, last year in 2016, he proved he was healthy. He threw 200 innings, which is great. But, he was just fine. As you said, more of a back-end starter, that 4.5 ERA. Didn't really show you that much. He didn't miss a ton of bats. So I don't think he's going to be an ace necessarily. But I do think he's better than that ERA made him out to look like, because he'd made that change in the middle of the year, and he stopped throwing his sinker, and he started throwing his slider and his cutter. And what's really fascinating about that is he had the highest ground ball rate of any starter, and that persisted even after he stopped throwing his sinker, which doesn't really kind of jive with what you'd expect. Now, what's interesting is because his slider gets grounders, and it gets missed bats, it gets strikeouts. So if you've got a pitch that good, you really ought to be relying on it more. And I think that's what we saw with him. He stopped throwing the sinker that was only okay, started throwing a pitch that would get grounders and strikeouts. You know, and as you said, if you look at his ERA by month, it was over 4 in April, over 4 in May, over 7 in June. And then the last 3 months of the season, 371, 313, 341. I mean, he's got a really impressive pitch. He throws like 6 different pitches. So would I say he's an ace? Probably not. But I do think there's a lot more in there than we saw last year. I think he can still be a good number 3, maybe number 2. I don't see him as a number 4 or 5 going forward. I'm a big buyer into Marcus Stroman.
Mike, I really wanted to ask you about James Paxton, because he's kind of been on my radar as a breakout pitcher for 2017. Talk to us maybe about what you've seen in him, because he has been pretty good over the past few seasons, just hasn't really put it all together. What makes you think he could put it all together this season?
Well, anytime I see a lefty who can touch 100 miles an hour, that is immediately someone I'm going to be drawn to. There was the fun game where he whiffed Mike Trout 4 times. I mean, that's, you can't do that by accident, right? You're not going to put too much emphasis in one game, but that's kind of a fun thing that stood out to me. But really, I look at him, and what drew me to him was his strikeout and walk numbers. Over the last couple of seasons, if you look at 2014, 2015, basically through the same amount of innings, about 70 innings, walk rate was just about exactly the same, just under 10%. Strikeout rate was just about exactly the same, about 19%. And then you look at 2016, he doubled his innings pitched through 121 innings, jumped that strikeout rate from 19% to 23%, and cut his walk rate in half. And that is really, really impressive to me. So I see a guy with the velocity like that. I see a guy who's really improved his plate discipline stats, and that's a guy to me that really stands out. Now, it's always about health with him, and at least last year he stayed off the disabled list, with the exception that he did get hurt because he got hit by a line drive. I like to think that's at least a fluke as opposed to some sort of chronic elbow injury or anything like that. I don't know if I ever see a 200-inning season from him, but I really look at a guy who can throw that hard and who made a really big step forward last year as someone, if he can maintain that, is going to be, I think, a big shock to people this year. He might, I'm going to go out on the limb and say something, insane here. I think he might be the best Seattle starter in 2016 and 2017. And I know that's crazy because Felix Hernandez is still there, but he's taken a bit of a step back, and I'm a big believer in just the raw talent and the improvements we saw to James Paxton.
And that tees us up for another hard-throwing lefty. Blake Snell was a guy who kind of came out of nowhere, I believe, 2 years ago, went from not really that highly regarded to really top-level prospect, and then delivered pretty well. I think, held his own pretty well. There seems to be an opportunity for him. He seems like he's going to get the chance, even with people coming back, with the health hopefully returning with the Rays. How much do you like him, given the sort of degree of difficulty? I mean, the AL East is not exactly what it was. Some guys are leaving, but, that's still a tough environment. It's still, as a lefty against some right-handed power in Boston, in Baltimore, how much does that factor in, or do you just kind of like the pitcher that much?
I like the pitcher. I'm a little worried about his control. He had a walk rate of almost 13%, which is like, twice as much as you want to see. So that's tough. He's going to have to be able to control that before I really buy into him as a true number one candidate. But he's a guy I kind of targeted early last year, even before he came up, just because of his fastball spin rate. And, that's obviously something we look at a lot at StatCast. And just a brief explainer, what that means is he's got a very high fastball spin rate. He's the third highest spin rate of any lefty starting pitcher last year. And a high spin rate on a fastball is very well correlated to swinging strikes, because it looks like a rising fastball really just means that it'll fall a little more slowly, and the hitter is prone to swing under it. And we saw that a lot. You look at him last year, he struck out 98 in 89 innings. You know, for a rookie, that's very, very good. And I really like that. That's a raw skill that can't be taught. You either have that high spin or you don't. So that's something that draws me to him, especially from the left side. Now, like I said, he's really got to work on the control. He can't keep walking as many as he did. And I will say that the home runs are a bit of an issue. And I think part of that is home runs are up across baseball. Part of that is a lot of the Rays pitchers had home run problems. And as you said, the AL East, not what it was. You know, Ortiz is gone, Encarnacion is gone. Maybe Trumbo is gone, but it's still not an easy division to pitch in. So I'm not looking at him as a number one, but I am looking at him as a guy who can be a pretty interesting mid-rotation candidate, just because the raw skills absolutely seem to be there. And, you know, so that's a guy that stands out to me for a lot of different reasons.
Do you think it's fair to say that of these guys, Snell may be the highest risk? If from a fantasy perspective, the upside is really high, but, you know, those guys who kind of dance on that line with walk rate, those guys who maybe are homer prone, do you think it's fair to say that of these guys, he may be the one that is the riskiest?
You know, I think that's probably fair, and it's interesting to say that because, you know, John Gray's in Coors Field, that's always a risk. Paxton's had some health issues, that's always a risk. But I think you're probably right, just because of those guys don't have the command issues that Snell did. And, you know, I don't know if that's something that can be taught or improved upon. I mean, maybe not immediately. So, yeah, if you can't hit the plate, then obviously that's going to impact everything else you do. You know, looking at the guys we talked about, I think Stroman probably has the highest floor. He is the most likely to at least be a competent, acceptable major league pitcher. He's probably got the lowest ceiling, too. I would say probably Paxton or Snell have the highest ceilings, just because I really like the velocity from the left side, the ability to miss bats that both of those guys have shown so far.
And then maybe a guy who kind of splits the difference on those. Robbie Ray is another guy. You know, it's funny that we talked about a lot of these guys here last year, and I think that makes sense, because if you've got a guy who is a breakout candidate, then he was probably right on the edge the year before. It's a tough, you know, and you talked about this. It's a tough environment. It's a place where you need people to catch the ball in the outfield. And part of your argument for him was that the pieces around him, that the context for him is going to be more favorable. Will that merely reveal a pitcher who was maybe better than people thought, or does that sort of go along with some further development of a pitcher?
Yeah, he's a really interesting case. He's very different from the other guys we talked about, because in a lot of ways he already was very good last year. I think, as you can tell, I'm always drawn to lefties who can miss bats, and Robbie Ray had a really impressive strikeout percentage. I think it was in the top five, really, or somewhere close to that. But, you know, you look at the traditional numbers, 8-15, a 4.90 ERA, that doesn't stand out. Gave up too many home runs, but I think a big problem with that was just, as you mentioned, the pieces around him weren't very good. You know, the outfield in Arizona last year, there's no other word for it, it was a disaster, right? They traded in Cearte, Pollock got hurt, Peralta got hurt, they had Weeks and Yasmani Tomas in the outfield. So they did not help any of their pitchers out, and obviously the ballpark doesn't help either. So, you know, you're hopeful that they'll have better health. Pollock should be back. Peralta should be back. Obviously, they've got a whole new regime there, and they also went out and got Jeff Mathis to catch, and Mathis can't hit it all, but he's a very good pitch framer who should help all the pitchers. So when I look at Ray, I already see a guy who can miss a ton of bats, and now the team around him will help. So I don't know that he's necessarily going to be a better pitcher in terms of the pitches he's throwing, but he's in a better position to succeed. All that has to bring down that ERA. And I still think it's a tough place to pitch, but he was just not in a very good spot last year. And you look at the whole Diamondbacks staff, none of the pitchers were very good last year. Even Zach Greinke didn't really live up to expectations. And I think the new regime is going to do a big thing to change that. So, you know, he's a guy you could maybe undervalue, just in the sense that his traditional numbers looked really bad. His ERA was almost 5. But if you can look past that and kind of dream on what the Diamondbacks are doing to improve, that's a guy who I would look at as kind of an undervalued starter who could really have a good year this upcoming season.
All right. Well, Mike Petriello, thanks very much for taking some time to chat with us here on the Fantasy 411. We should try and have you on again, and go to MLB.com. Everybody, the story is five pitchers poised to break out in 2017. And it is worth your time, as is pretty much everything Mike writes. He is one of the more compelling reporters that we have at MLB.com. So thanks for your time, Mike.
That is far too kind. Thanks very much, guys.
Definitely appreciate Mike taking some time to chat with us. And that leaves us with really just enough time, I think, to discuss the news since the last time we talked. Fred, a guy we talked about a lot, talked about a good bit this winter, talked about a good bit last year. Edwin Encarnacion is finally, officially as of this morning, going to Cleveland. I certainly like him more than Mike Napoli. I think in that regard it was an upgrade. I think that there are some reasons for, if not concern, at least caution. How highly do you rate Encarnacion going to Cleveland for 17?
Yeah, I'm fine with him in Cleveland. I think I know his home road splits were fine while he was with the Blue Jays, but he might miss Rogers Center a little bit. You know, hitting in Cleveland isn't especially conducive for a right-handed hitter such as Encarnacion. But my concerns with Encarnacion are not related to his team, and it's all related to the fact that he struck out much more often last season than he has in the past. And if that's a sign of his aging process and his bat slowing down a bit, or you know, that's my real concern with him. I think he's still going to hit 35 home runs and drive in 100 runs next season, but I don't think we're going to see him hit 40 home runs like he did in 2016 or drive in 127 runs like he did in 2016. To me, he's not in the first three rounds of a mixed league draft and kind of in the fourth round. I feel like, you know, yes, 35-ish home runs and 100 RBIs is a fine projection and maybe a 260 batting average. Matthew, do you think that's maybe about where he should be?
I might be a little more conservative on the average and the home runs. I'm a little concerned for two reasons, and one is, as you note, just the decline. He is beginning to get to that point where decline is natural. He has what, you know, many years ago Bill James referred to as old player skills. And look, as you know, he didn't have a huge home road split, but we have seen enough times, enough power guys go to Toronto and thrive that something works there, whether it's the lineup, whether it's scouting reports, whether it's coaching staff. I'm not in any way getting at any kind of silly man in white stuff, but like, there clearly is something that works with that lineup, that organization, that club for power hitters. And so even if it wasn't a home road thing, and it is a good place to hit, I do worry some about taking a guy out of what was so clearly a really good situation and putting him in a new situation. I think the RBI opportunities will be there. The top of that lineup should be very good. He will get those chances. He's going to hit in the heart of the order. RBI are the one thing I'm not that worried about. But I won't be shocked if he's in the 240s and 30 to 32 home runs. I don't think that's unreasonable at all. So I'm not totally down on him. But I sure don't like him as much in Cleveland as I would have if he'd stayed in Toronto.
Now, would you be completely shocked if Kendrys Morales was as productive as Encarnacion, you know, in 2017? Because, I mean, Morales hit 30 home runs, 93 RBIs, hit 263 last season, and that was with the Royals. Now, he goes to Toronto to basically replace Edwin. I mean, he's going to get drafted far, far later than Encarnacion will in every draft. Would you be shocked if he was similarly productive?
From a fantasy perspective, I would not be totally shocked. I don't like Morales nearly as much as a hitter, but part of that comes down to the fact that Encarnacion has a much better strike zone. So from a fantasy perspective, that doesn't matter quite as much. I will say this. I think relative to draft position or relative to auction value, I think there's a real good chance that Morales is a better draft day value than Encarnacion in 2017. I wouldn't take him before Encarnacion, or even within a couple rounds of Encarnacion, but I do think there's a good chance he's a better draft day value next year.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, because as much as we've said some negative things now about Encarnacion in the past couple minutes, he still has that upside to,
yes,
you know, prove us wrong, extend for another season, hit 38 or something home runs, and Morales can't touch that. You know, he could drive in 120 runs, and I don't think Morales can touch that, so... Yeah, I think what we're saying is we're wary of Encarnacion. And like I said, for that reason, to me, he's not a pick in the top three rounds, even though last season he was going in the second round in most drafts. And that's surprising to say for someone who went in the second round last year and then led the American League in RBIs. And then to say that I would move him down is, like, seems a little unnatural. But those strikeouts in his aging process do concern me, and it seems they concern you too.
I think the biggest difference between those two guys, I think that their ceilings are not that far apart, just because, again, you can conceive of something where Morales has a huge year in Toronto. To me, the difference is the floor. Encarnacion has been at least quite good for a whole bunch of years in a row. You only have to go back to 2014 when Morales was just flat awful. He had .218 with 8 home runs and 400 plate appearances in 2014. So, you know, that's the concern. He has, you know, his home run totals, even aside from that, 22, 23, 22, 30 over the past 5 years. He's got one season with more than 23 home runs. So, you know, the problem with Morales isn't the ceiling to me, because it wouldn't shock me if 1 year of this deal he has a huge year for some of the reasons I was just talking about. But it also wouldn't shock me if he was just bad, because he has that in him. And I don't think Encarnacion, it would be absolutely shocking if Encarnacion didn't hit 25 home runs. That would be stunning. It would be stunning if he hit .210. Those things are in play with Morales. They're not likely, but they're in play.
Yeah, I agree.
We move on to a guy who did stay, but also a guy where we talk about context a lot. Ivan Nova is somebody who really seemed to thrive upon arriving in Pittsburgh. Seems like a natural fit, a guy who can get ground balls in front of a team that is built to turn ground balls into outs. I was shocked that he didn't get more money. I really thought that the market was going to blow up for Nova. And I like him. He's not a guy I'm going to – I'll put it this way. He's not a guy I'm going to target. He's not a guy I'm going to say, oh, yeah, I want to be the person who gets Nova. But he's somebody where if I'm looking at options at the end of a draft, he'll be very high on my list among the sort of fungible back-year rotation starters.
Yeah, I see him the exact same way where, you know – actually, it's interesting that we had Mike on earlier on the show, because some of the StatCast data on Nova from last season isn't that impressive. He was among the worst in baseball for average exit velocity, you know, allowed, average fly ball distance allowed. That being said, the fly ball distance isn't as big of a problem with him getting a lot of ground balls. I mean, you and I both have a radar for pitchers that are in Pittsburgh. With his late season success, I think I see him the same way as you. You take him in the late rounds of the mixed league draft, and you hope that, you know, he becomes someone that can stay in your rotation and maybe gets you about a 3.7 ERA, something like that, and then a solid whip. Doesn't hurt your ratios next season, which is at the back end of your rotation. Someone who doesn't hurt your ratios is really helping you.
Right, that's the thing. And he's still probably a guy you're going to pick your spots with. You know, he's still a guy where, you know, if he's pitching at Wrigley, you may not want any part of that, but you can pick your spots with, and if you do that, I think you can have a pretty good year with him. Rajay Davis returns to Oakland, and the thing with Davis is it seems like he's going to play a lot. You know, that's probably a good thing, but I think that's sort of the question, because, you know, at 36, he's kind of a limited player. He had .249 last year, .258 the year before. He steals a lot of bases, and if he gets 500 plate appearances, he could steal 50 bases. But he also could hit .240, and I don't think there's any reasonable chance that he comes close to 12 home runs again. He scored 74 runs playing pretty regularly in a good lineup last year. It steals and not much else for Davis. So is it a good thing that Rajay Davis gets 500 plate appearances next year?
Well, from a baseball perspective, I'm not sure if it's a good thing. But, I mean, from a fantasy perspective, the scarcity of steals can make him quite valuable next season. It seems as though when you look at their roster as it's constructed right now that he's going to be the center fielder and he's going to be their leadoff hitter. They don't have – if he's their center fielder and gets 550 plate appearances, 500 at bat, something like that next year, steals 45 bases, hits 8 home runs, something like that. But he only bats maybe .240 or .245 because he's exposed to right-handed pitching a lot, which he's not great against. He's not a huge fantasy asset, but there's going to be a team in every mixed league that can use a 45 steal player. There are just so few, even 30 steal players to go around that. And I think if he's playing, he's stealing. I mean, if you look back even to his previous time with the A's, I know he's much younger than, but they let him run. And I think they know what they're getting into in bringing him back. Like, I don't think you bring Rajay Davis in to play regularly for you unless you're going to let him run, because otherwise, what's the point? So he's one of the few players that will have projected for more than 40 steals. That makes him really valuable in a mixed league.
We move to a guy that I like quite a bit. He's not somebody, again, a little like Nova. He's not somebody I'm going to go out of my way to target, but he's somebody I'd be very happy to have him fall my way. Wellington Castillo, over the past 2 years, and look, he's bounced around so much, it's kind of easy to lose sight of this. But it's a guy who you thought he was going to hit coming up, and even though he kind of started slow in the major leagues, he has, the last 2 years, hit pretty nicely. 2015, 2016, 835 plate appearances, 252, 33 home runs, 125 RBI. He now goes to another good place to hit. Now, he did a lot of that damage in Arizona, which is a good place to hit, but Baltimore is too. I think Castillo is a sneaky good choice. I don't think he's going to play all that much. That's a team that's not going to start him 130 times, and that may be the one concern. I suspect they will alternate catchers more than some teams, but I like Castillo, and I like him in Baltimore. I think he is, again, kind of a sneaky later rounds guy, not somebody I'm going out of my way to get, but somebody I'd be real happy to end up with. Where are you on Castillo?
Yeah, I mean, in a one-catcher league, whether it's 10 teams, 12 teams, I think he's that late round, you're kind of picking, you didn't take a catcher, you passed on Posey, you passed on Lucroy, you passed on Sanchez, you used your early round picks elsewhere, you even used your mid round picks elsewhere, and now you're just picking a guy out of him or Yadier Molina or maybe Russell Martin or something like that. I think he's kind of in that group. And, I can understand your optimism for him. I was disappointed with his home run total last season. It was 14. He actually hit six of those homers in April, and I think even most of those six were bunched into about a one-week or 10-day stretch where he hit about five. So after April last season, I mean, he only hit eight home runs. I was disappointed with that, and that's given me some reason for pause on him. I do think he has that potential to be especially on an American League team, to be a 20-home run, 70, 75 RBI catcher, and in a 10 or 12-team league with one catcher, that makes him a viable late-round option.
I also kind of want to reverse one thing I noted, because he will not catch 120 games, but the flip side of that is, as you note in the American League, if he becomes a guy who is somebody they want to get in the lineup, he can also get in the lineup occasionally at DH. The Marlins construct not the Super Bullpen they wanted, but the Super Bullpen they end up with. They bring in a whole bunch of guys. Brad Ziegler is the last one. And it's such a weird mix, because there are a bunch of guys. I love the real-world baseball possibility of going from Ziegler to Bearclaw. Things like that look like a lot of fun. But I think it raises some questions about Ramos, just in that they don't need to stick with him if he falters at all. And I think that that's a club that would be willing to make a change. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on them early in the year. I think that they know that their window is relatively tight right now and they need to win. I'm not sure they're going to be all that good. So that combination means that could be a quick trigger finger in the ninth inning. So the guys they bring in most recently, Ziegler, what does that do to your confidence level in Ramos?
Yeah, I mean, and I think you can tie in, like, we talk numbers a lot, but then we also like to talk just those soft aspects of baseball where we're trying to read the tea leaves on things. And it's not even just Ziegler. It's the fact that the Marlins were chasing Chapman and Jansen and, like you said, trying to build a super bullpen. And then you go back to last season and they replaced Ramos when they had the chance. Like, he had a really brief disabled stint. They replaced him with Fernando Rodney, and they were cool with running with Rodney until he basically gave them no choice but to go back to Ramos. And you look at that, and you're like, man, Fernando Rodney, like, isn't A.J. Ramos a better pitcher? And you don't want to go back to – you don't want to go to Fernando Rodney as your closer? I'm just starting to get the impression that the Marlins just don't really want Ramos to be their closer or don't feel comfortable with that. Like, are you feeling the same thing?
Yeah, I think that's clear, and they can say all they want about we love AJ and we're just building around him, but it's clear that they wanted to bring in guys who weren't just good, but who had pitched the ninth, and therefore presumably they would be comfortable putting in the ninth. And again, Ziegler's not the only one of those guys. The other question here, and you mentioned this in your notes to me, and it's a guy that I'm a big fan of. I love Kyle Barraclough. But you got to think his value is diminished some, because he goes from a guy who could get you 100 strikeouts and could sneak into 10 saves to a guy who almost certainly is only going to get you those 100 strikeouts, not the saves. And, in fact, the way they're going to divvy up the innings might not get the innings to get as many strikeouts as you'd like.
Yeah, totally. I think he's off the mixed league radar now for me. I mean, to own a middle reliever setup man in a mixed league, it has to be one of two things. You have to know that he's really close to getting saves. You know, it only takes one injury or one, you know, player to have a poor performance, and he'll start getting saves. And that's not the case anymore with Barraclough. Or his ratios have to be so ridiculously good, and his strikeout total has to be so ridiculously good, like a Dellin Betances or an Andrew Miller, even if he's not getting saves, that you'll take him anyways. And Barraclough, with his whip still high enough because the control is shaky, that he does not helping a mixed league team just with the 100 strikeouts. So for me now, he's just straight NL only, where he definitely does have some value.
And one more move of note. The Red Sox finally part ways with Clay Buchholz. They send him to Philadelphia, where I'm trying to talk myself out of him because I know he's been really inconsistent. I know that he's no longer the guy that we sort of thought of him as a few years ago, but going to Philly, it's certainly a friendlier environment, even with the ballpark, to be out of the DH league, to be facing the Braves. The Nationals and Marlins are good offenses, but I don't think they're quite what he might see on a regular basis. I'm trying to talk myself out of him because I know he's not actually that good, but I kind of can see this working. Where are you on Buchholz?
Okay, I'm going to talk you out of him, and I'm going to actually use one of your own lines to talk you out of him, because when this transaction happened, I thought back to something you said to me on this podcast late last season. I was talking about streaming him for a two-start week, and you commented, I don't have your exact wording, but you commented on that maybe I was chasing the Buchholz of old and not him, you know, from his like most recent performances. And that was something I really thought about. So I started to get intrigued. And then I looked back, like after this trade, I looked back at really how he pitched last season. I know he had stretches where he was doing better, but I mean, his strikeout to walk ratio last season was way down from what it was in some of the previous campaigns. He was struggling with home runs last year. I know the move is good, like American League, National League, good, AL East to NL East, good, but I just don't know if the skills are there. We're just chasing the Buchholz we knew from a few years ago, and I don't know if the skills are there anymore. Now, would I take him in the last round of a mixed league and put him on my bench for a couple starts to find out? Maybe, but how about this? I think we would both much rather have a Von Nova. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, for sure. That'd be an easy call for me.
Yeah, in a 10 or 12 team league, I think you can still get guys like Nova. I think there'll be other pitchers that I'm actually intrigued with late in the draft by their skills, so I don't have to reach just for Buchholz in a situation. But I will say that maybe Buchholz is a streaming type guy where when he has a favorable two-start week, you pluck him off waivers and use him for a week. And maybe he will prove me wrong and be better than I thought. But, I mean, looking at that, I'm really trying with him to separate his recent skills from the name Clay Buchholz, because that name to me, until we talked in September when I was thinking about streaming him, that name didn't inspire still a bit of excitement in me.
I think that's perfectly fair. Would you put him clearly behind Jeremy Hellickson?
I'm not a big Hellickson fan, but I'm going to put him behind Hellickson just because last season Hellickson was really consistent. I do think Hellickson's going to regress. I would rather take any of the young guys in the Phillies rotation, Aaron Nola, Vince Velasquez, Jared Eichhoff. I'd rather have any of those than either of those two veterans. I know that those young guys, like Velasquez, really frustrating at times. Nola really struggled at times last season and then was hurt. I don't know. I'd rather just go for that upside in a draft than go with one of those veterans.
I think that's fair, and particularly with Buchholz, where the worry, the question is, does he still have the upside? Because the problem is, he definitely still has the downside. I mean, the problem with Buchholz is you know the risk is there. You know that some starts he's going to get drilled. And so, you know, the question is, does he still have the upside? And you talk about the kids there, you know they do. You know Nola has the upside. You know Velasquez has the upside. So if you're going to suffer through some bad ones, you can at least be confident that you got a pretty good chance of getting some good ones.
Yeah, and it's a dual downside with Buchholz. If you invest a late round pick and he gets injured, it's not that big of a deal. But there's that dual downside with him. He could pitch poorly, or he could just not pitch. This is someone who hasn't produced a lot of innings in the past few seasons.
Well, I'm officially talked out. That's why talked out of play Buchholz. That's why Fred is a pro here. That's the Fantasy 411 this week. Thanks everybody for listening. Thanks Mike Petriello for taking some time to talk with us, and thanks Fred Zinke for your time.